In most presidential election years, the Electoral College process is an afterthought, a foregone conclusion. But with President Donald Trump poised to only leave the White House if he is dragged out kicking and screaming, we wanted to learn more about the meeting of state electors scheduled for December 14th, which will formally cement the victory of Joe Biden. And to give us an introductory class on the American election system, we spoke to Ava Ayers, an assistant professor and director of the Government Law Center at Albany Law School, which has produced such luminaries as Andrew Cuomo and my father. Welcome to the show, Ava.
It's great to be with you, Dave. Thank you.
So for starters, can you give us a reminder of how many members of the Electoral College there are, how Electoral College votes are apportioned, and how many votes in the Electoral College are needed to actually secure your spot in the White House?
Absolutely. The Electoral College is the people who, in fact, choose the American president every 4 years. There are 538 of them. They are chosen on a state-by-state basis. Whoever wins the popular vote in most states gets a certain number of electors from that state. Now, most states apportion the electors on a winner-take-all basis, meaning here in New York, where we have 29 electors, the winner of our popular vote, which was, of course, Joe Biden, gets all 29 of those votes. Maine and Nebraska have a slightly different system in which each of them has two electoral college votes that are assigned by district rather than winner-take-all. The other 48 states, it's winner-take-all. The electors are, generally speaking, chosen by the party committees before the elections. So we knew who they were going to be before you voted. Here in New York, they include many Democratic Party luminaries. The Republicans also chose a slate of electors, knowing, given presidential history and polling, that it was unlikely they would have to show up and vote. But that's who they are. They're the folks you're really voting for when you cast your vote at the ballot box.
And that threshold that you need to get across the finish line, what is that?
270. The members of the Electoral College, how many votes there are, is determined by two things: how many senators your state has and how many members of the House of Representatives. Of course, every state has two senators, and House votes are apportioned on the basis of population. So small states can have as few as three electors. That's one for the House and two for the Senate. The District of Columbia, not being a state, nonetheless gets three electors. That's how we get up to 538. U.S. territories like Puerto Rico and the other U.S. territories do not get any representation in the Electoral College. So we have 29 here in New York, and everybody else varies. This is, of course, the subject of significant controversy because it means that smaller states essentially get triple the power. If your population entitles you to only one vote on the basis of population, nonetheless, you have your senators who get you two votes. So Vermont and Wyoming have triple the voting power per capita that you have in a state like New York or California.
You mentioned that 48 of the states apportion their Electoral College votes based on the winner of the popular vote for that state, and that's the only way they do it. When electors, you know, when it's time to actually cast their ballot, are there any rules that govern what they do? Is there any chance there could be a wild card? You know, for some reason, Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's a Democratic elector for Joe Biden, you know, when it's his turn to cast the ballot, somehow pulls a wild card and puts down Ava Ayers' name?
So what you just described is called faithless electors, those who vote for somebody other than the winner of the popular vote for whom they were chosen to vote. There are 33 states that have laws that prevent that from happening in one of two ways. Either it's by threatening them with fines, or probably even more of an ironclad guarantee, by providing in the law that if an elector casts a faithless vote, that vote counts as their resignation, which means they are automatically kicked out of the Electoral College and someone else is swapped in. That person, of course, would also be kicked out if they were faithless, and you continue until you get somebody who toes the party line. Faithless electors are very unusual in history. So even in a state like New York, which does not have a faithless elector statute, there's not a history of electors casting votes for other folks, largely because of who they are. If you're a prominent official or activist who's chosen by the political party, it's quite rare that you cast a faithless vote. Now, it does happen. In 2016, there were three Democratic electors in the state of Washington who decided that instead of casting their votes for Hillary Clinton, they were going to cast their votes for Colin Powell, not because they thought he should be president. They were hoping that given that President Trump had lost the popular vote, they hoped that their independence would inspire a streak of other independent electors in Republican states to swap away from Trump for someone else. It didn't work. As you know, Donald Trump did become president, but the Supreme Court later upheld Washington's law that imposes sanctions on electors who vote faithlessly. So we know states can tell electors they have to vote for the designated candidate.
It hasn't always been the case that electors were chosen as a result of the popular vote in the state. That was more, I guess I would say, a guidance for how things might move forward. And I think it's safe to say that state legislators were much more heavily involved in picking the electors. And we're seeing that discussion, I think, and that role of state legislatures reemerge right now as the president tries a Hail Mary in Michigan, where he's looking to have, what, the legislature intervene prior to December 14th and figure out a new way to distribute those electors. What's going on there? What is the president's hope, and is it something that was realistic at any point?
Right. So this is a different problem than the one I just described, but they're related. When I said that states have a lot of power to tell electors what to do, the Constitution allows state legislatures a whole lot of power over how electors cast their votes. And there's always been a theory, it's never happened, but there's always been a theory that electors could choose to just disregard the popular vote, and that legislatures could tell them to do that, could dictate how the electors are supposed to vote, to say, we're not going to have an election, you know, in North Carolina this year. The state legislature will just choose the best person for president and direct the members of the Electoral College by law to vote for that person. Now, whether the Supreme Court would uphold that in general, hard to say because we haven't had it happen. But there's a difference this year between those sort of far-out scenarios and the world that we're in. The key difference is that the election here is over, and every state has already passed laws governing elections procedures under which the winner of the popular vote gets the votes in the Electoral College. There are procedures for that. For a law to be passed after the election, not telling the electors in advance how to vote, but telling them, we don't like the results, so we're changing them, there's very, very good reason to think that that would be unlawful, potentially in a number of different ways. Nonetheless, you're quite right. That is what Trump and some Republicans are trying to arrange. We, at the time we're recording this, we're about an hour away from a meeting that Trump is going to be having with Republican leaders in the Michigan state legislature, apparently in an effort to persuade them to do just this kind of thing. There is no reason to think it's going to work. Virtually all Republican state legislators in states that have a Republican legislature have said that they will not do this. Moreover, it would have to be a state law, which means that the governor of the states in question would have to not veto it. And of course, Michigan has a Democratic governor, Gretchen Wilmer, who would certainly veto any attempt to go back and undo the election by sending the electors in another direction.
You don't think she has a special affinity for the president after he had such kind remarks when it came out that there was a kidnapping plot against her?
Right. It doesn't seem like she has any particular reason to let the election be overthrown just as a favor to him, no.
So our actual voting process in every state is actually overseen by the states themselves. They're the ones responsible for administering our elections. What about the Electoral College elections? Who's actually responsible for collecting all these votes from these electors and actually making sure they get to Congress late December?
It's a great question, because just as you say, there really are two different elections happening. One is the election in the states, and one is the Electoral College. And in the federal system, there are provisions of the U.S. Constitution and federal law that govern how the Electoral College works. And it happens first in the states. So on December 14th, it's going to be a fancy event in the New York State Capitol at noon. You can watch the last one on YouTube, the 2016 Electoral College meeting, and you'll see it lasted for about 45 minutes. And there's a band, and there's, you know, singing, and there's color guard, and there are some beautiful old-looking wooden boxes into which people drop their little ballot cards.
I got to interrupt. They're singing? Who sings?
Oh, they had a school choir. I think it was from Albany High School, actually.
Do you know if they've booked anyone for 2020, or is this something where I could still throw my hat in the ring?
You're trying to get in there? Yeah, I don't know. I would call the governor's office and see. I think that
I do a good Elvis rendition.
Ooh, I don't.
Oh.
So more power to you. The event is fairly exciting. You know, Bill Clinton and Andrew Cuomo walk up together to cast the first vote in the Electoral College. And there are provisions of the federal statute that deal with what happens next. All the electors have to sign 6 certificates, and they're sent to a lot of different places, I guess, in case one gets lost. They're sent to Congress, of course, to the Secretary of State of New York. One's sent to the National Archives, where we keep all of our, you know, precious national records. One's sent to the local district court judge. And then it's sent off by, you know, registered mail to D.C. In all of those forms, and Congress receives them. So there's a second key event in the life of the Electoral College process, which is Congress counting the votes. So all of the votes arrive. There's a meeting on the floor of the U.S. Congress where the votes are counted under the supervision of the sitting vice president. So that will actually be Mike Pence presiding over the counting of the votes as they are read out. And there's an opportunity to object. So people can try to object on certain limited grounds that are there in the federal statute. But Congress is, on January 6th, going to read out the Electoral College votes. And that's the moment at which the last ballot in this election will finally have been counted.
20 years ago, if I asked this question, I think the answer would be a simple no. Institutional norms, traditional democratic norms,
yeah,
what have you, ensure that no one's going to object. But now in 2020, rounding the corner for 2021, is there an expectation that there's going to be likely a Republican member of Congress who is going to make some sort of objection on January 6th when that formal process happens?
Right. I don't have any specific reports on that, but I'd be almost shocked if someone didn't. Now, the reason that won't be nearly the problem it often is when things get gummed up in Congress is that the rules are very clear. There's no argument about the objections on the floor, which limits the opportunity for Senate-like filibusters. And as the House counts the votes, certain requirements have to be met. They, you can watch the last one of this on YouTube, too, where actually at least one Democratic representative tried to object to President Trump's votes, and Vice President Biden shut her down.
So it's not as uncommon as I made it sound.
It doesn't seem that way, no. But there are only limited bases on which the objections can be upheld. And in most cases, it would require a consensus of the House and the Senate to suppress a vote. So even if the Republican Senate majority held in favor of essentially reversing the election and throwing it to President Trump, which is highly unlikely, I think, by the way, there's, you know, certainly Mitt Romney wouldn't go there, and we'll see how the Georgia election comes out. But well, even if it's the old, you know, you're talking about Murkowski, Collins being willing to overthrow the outcome of an American election. And I think that's hard to imagine. But even if they were willing to, the House isn't going to do that.
Right.
So you're not talking about a realistic prospect that the objections could overturn the election. But I think what you said is very important. 20 years ago, we would have been talking about norms. And we're now in a very different climate where even the discovery of an anti-democratic option, such as filing objections to try to disenfranchise the voters of a state like Pennsylvania or Georgia or Wisconsin or Michigan, even mentioning that possibility makes it almost immediately something that people on the right in Trump's camp start clamoring for, and Republican politicians start feeling they can't denounce, they can't invoke those norms without fear of, you know, being primaried or otherwise attacked by the Trump side of the party. So we are in a very different place. And the fact that it's implausible this cycle doesn't mean we shouldn't be very concerned for the future.
And finally, as someone who is obviously spending a lot of time with the Electoral College, and has been studying it and is talking about it a lot right now. Do you feel like the Electoral College is a great way to elect a president, or do you feel like it's the greatest way to elect a president?
Well, that's a perfect question. That's just the way to say it, and that's what all the professors are arguing about these days. No one has ever recorded a majority of the American people supporting the Electoral College. If it weren't for the incredible difficulty of amending the U.S. Constitution, it would have been gone a long time ago. And in fact, you can read big fat books on the weird miracle of the Electoral College's survival, given the fact that we have made constitutional changes to other aspects of our federal election system. So you can talk to historians about why it survived. But, you know, not only does it create the possibility for what we saw in 2000 and 2016 and three times earlier in our history, a president who has lost the popular vote, it also systematically violates the otherwise widespread constitutional norm of one person, one vote, that your vote, as it is, should count the same as an equally wise person in Wyoming or Vermont. But in fact, you matter much less in the presidential election system than they do. And there are consequences in terms of who's disenfranchised and in terms of the enormous confusion, which I think is a pretty small harm compared to the other ones I just named. But the fact that Americans see this as if it were some elaborate game of a foreign sport that they rarely pay attention to, and that the outcome is thought manipulable in so many ways, I think is partly due to a widespread doubt about the legitimacy of a process this complicated and mysterious, which is known to reverse the will of the people in any number of scenarios. So the Electoral College not only is the opposite of democracy in some situations, it also damages the legitimacy. And as we've seen in this election, a lot depends on the perceived legitimacy of our election system. You see a lot of Republican election officials standing up for themselves and their work, standing up for the work of the thousands of people in the local elections districts who have been working hard to make sure the votes are counted accurately. We depend on that. We depend on each and every one of those people to do good work, to do it in a nonpartisan way, and to respect the idea that we argue in the United States hard about who the president should be, and we do not argue in the same way about who the president is. When that norm deteriorates, our election dies, and everything that chips away at it should be questioned, and certainly the Electoral College is one of those things.
Our guest has been Ava Ayers, an assistant professor and director of the Government Law Center at Albany Law School. Ava, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.